Blog Talk Radio.
Up to that idea, which I did many number of years ago,
haven't been the same since, quite honestly, probably about 10 years ago. My eyes opened wide. I was hit by a sledgehammer reality more than once, I'll tell you, till it sunk in. And I realized that life is a vast conspiracy. Life as we know it. It's small conspiracies and large conspiracies and global conspiracies. And it's all conducted by a few men or women or a small group of people against another group of people or the larger group of people who are trying to manipulate to their benefit large groups of people, you know, to create either revolutions or to create total control or to create whatever it may be. You know, just to, even to sell you a, you know, a brand of toilet paper, you know, it's a conspiracy. It's a mind wash. It's a propaganda. It's a plan that somebody orchestrated somewhere in some office somewhere, think tank. Somebody came up with an idea, spoke to somebody else, and they said, gee, that's a good idea. We can do a lot with that. And then, you know, it took off. And I think that one of the more revealing and compelling reports that I ever read was the report from Iron Mountain, right? And I hope to agree. I hope you will. I want to read some of this tonight. It's not very long, but it kind of explains the global picture. And it's a long chapter that goes into. This again is by Jim Mars, Rule by Secrecy. But let me just explain what this is. Conspiracy writers have long accused members of secret societies of using their tortured power and influence to light the fires of war. They have been charged with fomenting the Cold War, two world wars, the American, French, and Russian revolutions, along with countless other conflicts and revolts. It is also claimed that these hidden hands can be traced directly to the secret organizations of the past. And a careful study of history indeed reveals the telltale fingerprints of the secret societies throughout the history of warfare. Of all human activities, war alone offers the greatest potential for profit, both from war materials and from the loans to produce them. And there are deeper rationales, such as the need to distract the public from their domestic troubles as well as the hidden agendas of their rulers. American capitalism, this is a quote by Howard Zinn, American capitalism needed international rivalry and periodic war to create an artificial community of interest between rich and poor, supplanting the genuine community of interests among the poor that showed itself in sporadic moments. And wrote history professor Howard Zinn. This view was addressed in detail in a controversial 1966 study of War and Peace called the Report from Iron Mountain. I hope that you will maybe. You have read this before or read about it or heard about it, or perhaps you haven't ever heard about it. But I want to get into this tonight because I want to show you how something that in 1966 has essentially a report by several notable figures were brought together and created this, they call them the Iron Mountain Boys, right, who came up with this idea. And it began in 1963 and was later published in, I believe, in 66. This is a report from Iron Mountain. This is from The Rule by Secrecy of Jim Morris. The study that led to the reports from Iron Mountain began in 1961 with Kennedy administration officials such as George Bundy, who was a CFR member, Bilderberger member, and Skull and Bones. Robert McNamara, trilateralist, CFR, and Bilderberger. Dean Rusk, CFR, and Bilderberger. Now, by the way, Bundy, of course, was involved with the CIA. Robert McNamara was the Secretary of Defense under Johnson. Dean Rusk, I believe, was the Secretary of State, all right, under Kennedy. Johnson, right? Knowing of Kennedy's goal of ending the Cold War, these men were concerned that there has been no serious planning for long-term peace. In early 1963, a special study group was selected to study the hypothetical problems of peace, just as government think tanks such as the Rand and Hudson Institute studied war. The 15 members of this group have never been publicly identified, but it reportedly included highly regarded historians, economists, sociologists, psychologists, scientists, and even an astronomer and industrialist. The group met about once a month at various locations around the nation. But its principal meetings were at Iron Mountain, a huge underground corporate nuclear hideout near Hudson, New York, site of Hudson Institution, widely regarded as a CFR think tank. There, here, in case of nuclear attack, were housed redundant corporate offices of Rockefeller-controlled Standard Oil of New Jersey, the Morgan Bank, a manufacturer's Hanover Trust, and the Dutch Shell Oil, then headed by Bilderberger founder Prince Bernard. A copy of the report from Iron Mountain was leaked by a man identified only as John Doe, a Midwestern University professor who claimed to have been a participant. It was published by Dial Press in 1967. John Doe told the publisher that while he agreed with the findings of the study, he disagreed with the group's decision to conceal their work from the public, unexposed to the exigencies of higher political or military responsibility. He said he believed the American public, whose tax money paid for the report, had a right to know its disturbing conclusions, while his fellow authors feared the clear and predictable danger of a crisis in public confidence, which untimely publication of the report might be expected to provoke. Over the years, the report from Iron Mountain was received little or no publicity, and certain members of government and media have attempted to brush it off as a joke or satire. But Dial Press published this work with no such disclaimers, and the serious and erudite tone of this footnoted study, along with its global and macro-analytical approach, belies the charge of fiction. It is an amazing document written at the outset of our national experience in Vietnam, and most certain reflects the elitist views of those who are said to have solicited the study. John Doe said that the Iron Mountain Boys, as they called themselves, conducted an informal, off-the-book secret study uninhibited by normal government restraints. They submitted their report in March of 1966. According to the report, war itself is the basic social system within which other secondary modes of social organization conflict or conspire. It is the system which has governed most human society hard as it is today. The report's authors saw war as both necessary and desirable. The principal organizing force, as well as the essential economic stabilizer of modern societies. So there you go, folks. That's why we still have war, and we will not stop. They expressed concern that through ambiguous leadership, the ruling administrative class might lose its ability to rationalize a desired war, leading to the actual disestablishment of military institutions, as eventually they viewed as catastrophic. Therefore, the report writers concluded, we must first reply as strongly as we can that the war system cannot responsibly be allowed to disappear until, one, we know exactly what form of social control we plan to put in its place, and two, we are certain beyond reasonable doubt that these substitute institutions will serve their purposes. So in other words, you won't have war when they can completely control a society. But until then, you'll always have war because it's always profitable. And it's always, it always works. Therefore, the report writers concluded, or rather, number two, says, we are certain beyond reasonable doubt that these substitute institutions will serve their purpose. Most significantly, the report states, the elimination of war implies the inevitable elimination of national sovereignty and the traditional nation-state. It added, the possibility of war provides a sense of external necessity without which no government can long remain in power, and the basic authority of a modern state over its people resides in its war powers. In other words, the only way that a government stays in power is being able to kill you, basically. They have the military and police power. Whether it's a democracy or not, you still have to worry about this powers. Most significantly, the report states the elimination of war implies the inevitable elimination of a national sovereignty and traditional nation-state. It added, the possibility of war provides a sense of external necessity without which no government can long remain in power, and the basis authority of modern state over its people resides in its war powers. Which is fascinating, folks. I mean, that's basically how it works. And the report goes on to say that war has served as the last great safeguard against the elimination of necessary social classes, hewers of wood and drawers of water, and the war functions to control essential class relationships. Its authors credited military institutions with providing antisocial elements with an acceptable role in the social structure. It is not hard to visualize, for example, the degree of social disruption that might have taken place in the United States during the last two decades if the problem of the socially disaffected of the post-World War II period had not been foreseen and effectively met, noted the report. The younger and more dangerous of these hostile social groupings have been kept under control by the selective service system, the draft. In the past, juvenile delinquents often were given the choice of going to jail or into the army. The report suggests that what should be done with the economically or culturally deprived among us? A possible surrogate for the control of potential enemies of society is the reintroduction, in some form consistent with modern technology and political process of slavery. The development of a sophisticated form of slavery may be an absolute prerequisite for social control in a world at peace. Perhaps this refers to the current growth practice of private businesses utilizing prison labor or to wage slaves, those so mired in credit that they have lost any option but to work, to continue working for wages in an unfulfilling job. And boy, do we have that now. All right. If anybody will take a job right now, any kind of job, just to get some kind of money, you know, and to pay off their bills. It is highly intriguing to compare the recommendations of this report with life in the United States today. The Iron Mountain Boys listed these possibilities, possible substitutes for the function of war. Here it goes, folks. This is an eye-opener, I tell you. A comprehensive social welfare program. A giant, open-ended space research program aimed at unreachable targets. That was NASA. Missions to Jupiter, Mars, you know, Moon. A permanent, ritualized, ultra-elaborate disarmament inspection system, as in Iraq and in Bosnia. So in other words, now you got to remember, this book was written in 2000. A disarmament inspection system. An omnipresent, virtually omnipotent international police force. A UN peacekeeping force, as in the Persian Gulf War for the Balkans. So they want total omnipotence, total omnipresence. An established and recognized extraterrestrial menace, UFOs and alien abductions. So, in other words, you know, they feel you. You know, they want you to believe in UFOs and alien abductions, which would totally explain, you know, the UFOs took them, not the police or the military, and sent them for unrecognition. Oh no, it was the UFOs. You know. Massive global environmental pollution. So they had to create massive global pollution. Why is this? Fictitious alternative enemies, alternate enemies. Saddam Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi, Slobodan Milosevic, and whoever follows them. Of course, we have to, you know, think about Ahmadinejad, of course. Oh yeah, terrible guy, right? Gaddafi is listed in here. Look what they did to Gaddafi. Okay, so in other words, there has to be or Saddam Hussein, you know, and of course Osama bin Laden. So and now the terrorists, and so in other words, fictitious alternate enemies had to be created. Programs generally derived from the Peace Corps model, the Job Corps, volunteers in service to America. I notice they're trying to reenact that. They haven't been very successful, but they may wind up doing that. But they needed, they wanted to put together this, they did have back in the 60s, under Kennedy with the Peace Corps and Job Corps and volunteers in service to America. In fact, I remember applying to VISTA back in 71. I wanted to work for VISTA. And, you go off to send an Indian reservation or to a town or whatever, you know, poverty area, and you work with the people there. And, and for a while they were taking people right out of high school, but with a college, with a high school education. But by 1971, when I applied, they rejected me because they were only looking now for people with college degrees. Right? So that because they didn't have much luck with the people without college degrees. You know, they needed some kind of an education. They needed more qualified people to join. So I was rejected from that, but I remember this program. And, of course, the Peace Corps. And a modern, sophisticated form of slavery. address the globe in the debt slavery, modern, sophisticated form of slavery, and that's what we are, folks. So you got to remember, in order for us not to be at war, all of these things have to be in place. But the problem is that even with all these things in place, we're still at war. All right, explain that one. New religions or other mythologies, New Age theologies, cults, etc. They said that these have to be part of our society. These have to be built in. All right, so New Age religions and so on were all part of this. This scheme, to manipulate modern society. Socially oriented blood games, National Football League, World Wrestling Federation, right? So, yeah, people are crazy about these things, and so that's why, back in the '60s, you had the beginning of the Super Bowl and the Green Bay Packers and all these great teams that they still live on in infamy today, and World Wrestling Federation, of course. These were blood sports, and a comprehensive program of applied eugenics, abortion, and birth control. So, in other words, they had to promote birth control and eugenics. And now they're promoting eugenics at a rate unprecedented, between infecting our foods, vaccinations, chemtrails, pollution, air pollution, water pollution. It's just all around us, and they're trying to. And this is all part and parcel of what these guys had developed back in 1963. They said this is what has to be done. We have to do all this stuff in order to create this nightmare. And they also said, the authors admitted that alternate enemies might prove unlikely, but stressed that one must be found. This is where they found, they came up with 911, the Oklahoma bombings, whatever it was that they needed to create, that alternate enemies might prove unlikely, but stressed that one must be found, emphasis in the original, or more probably that such a threat will have to be invented. And Al-Qaeda was invented by the CIA. We know this for a fact. Osama bin Laden was a CIA operative. We know this. Osama bin Laden was not responsible for 9/11. We know this for a fact. Finally, the Iron Mountain Special Study Group proposed the establishment by presidential order of a permanent and top-secret war peace research agency organized along the lines of National Security Council, outside the purview of Congress, the media, and the public, provided with non-accountable funds and responsible solely to the president. The purpose of this agency would be peace research, to include creating the above-listed substitutes for the functions of war and the unlimited right to withhold information on its activities and its decisions from anyone except the president, wherever it deemed such secrecy to be in the public interest. No one seems to know or is willing to tell if such a secret agency was ever considered or created. Regardless if it was or not, the tone of this proposal is certainly conspiratorial, and it has hatched by men. It was hatched by men connected to the secret societies whose class-conscious objectives are reflected in this report. These same men were responsible for the involvement of America in Vietnam in the 1960s and 70s, and their mindset was behind the attempt to foment war in Nicaragua in the 1980s as well as the conflicts of the 1990s in the Middle East and the Balkans. In human terms, it is an outrageous document, committed Leonard C. Lewin, who arranged for the report's publication. And it explains, or certainly appears to explain, aspects of American policy otherwise incomprehensible by the ordinary standards of common sense. Despite the study of peace as this Cold War drew to a close in the early 1990s, there was one more large-scale, seemingly incomprehensible modern war to further the aims of those secret society men who seek profit from hostilities: war in the Persian Gulf. There we are, folks, leading us up to today. All right. I mean, it just gets better and better and better, doesn't it? I mean, maybe I'm talking out of my rear end, but I'm not. I mean, I'm reading this stuff. I'm reading this from a well-researched, well-respected author, Jim Marsden, who researched this, who got all this information. He's got a tremendous bibliography back here and appendix and so on. And, I mean, you can get all this stuff. I mean, this is all stuff that's out there, man. I mean, this is all real stuff. I mean, this is all published works and all government reports and secret society reports. And, you know, this is all out there. But anyway, this all led to the to getting us in 2000 with the big George W. Bush and, of course, PNAC, okay, whose major concern, of course, was to invade the Middle East, so under Bush we, started playing around with Kuwait and Iraq and so on, and Iran. And in the 70s we got our nose bent in Iran, right? And they kicked us out of there in 79. And Iran has been the great American nemesis ever since, which is a joke. And we've been the great Iranian nemesis ever since. And the first way, and the best way to get back in was to, what, invade Iraq? No. Afghanistan, now it looks like we're moving into playing games with Pakistan. All of this is still happening. But let me continue this in the sense that let's talk about the Persian Gulf. The Allied victory in the Persian Gulf War of 1991 was loudly trumpeted by the American mass media. But the actions leading to this conflict were sparsely reported throughout the coverage. These machinations involve people in secret societies and indicated a very different rationale for the war than the one presented to the public. No one can argue that the United States military, with some assistance from British, French, and Arab forces, did not perform magnificently during their brief conflict. It took only between January 17th and February 28th, 1991, for the coalition of Operation Desert Storm to soundly defeat the Iraqi forces of Saddam Hussein, then representing the fifth largest army in the world. This astounding military success was due primarily to the Allied forces' superiority in both weaponry and training, as opposed to Saddam's conscripts, who, though veterans of combat against Iran, had limited training and low morale. This disparity created a lopsided war which resulted in more than 300,000 Iraqi casualties, both military and civilian, and 65,000 prisoners, compared to the extraordinarily low Allied losses of 234 killed, 470 wounded, and 57 missing. Primary leader of the war was U.S. President George Bush, former CFR member, trilateralist, and skull and bonesman. This is George Bush Sr. As with most Middle East conflicts, the primary issue is oil. Both Bush and then Secretary of State James Baker were deeply involved in the oil business. Any Bush policy which increased the price of oil meant more profit to his companies and those of his oil men's supporters, and of course, to the Rockefeller-dominated oil cartel. An added bonus was that any conflict which divided the Arab world would only strengthen the power of the U.S., Britain, and Israel in the region. A coalition of countries fighting for the United Nations could only advance the globalist plan for a one-world military force. The Battle of the New World Order was some kind of manufactured crisis with a hidden agenda, wrote conspiracy researchers Jonathan Vankin and John Whalen. After careful study of the events leading to this conflict, Bush and Saddam Hussein had had a close relationship for many years. In his role as CIA director, the latter, as Vice President George Bush, had supported Saddam Hussein through the 8-year war against Iran following the ouster of the Shah in 1979. In 1990, Saddam's Iraq was a primary threat to the balance of power between Israel and its Arab neighbors. But Saddam was strapped for cash due to his Iraq-Iran war and couldn't pay his bills. Under pressure from the international bankers for slow repayment of loans and for organization of petroleum-producing countries, OPEC, which refused to allow him to raise oil prices, Saddam turned his eyes to Kuwait as a source of income. At that time, it was the third largest producer of oil next to Iraq and Saudi Arabia. Kuwait had been carved out of Iraq by Britain, who in 1899 took control of Kuwait's foreign policy under an agreement with the dictatorial Sabah family. The Sabahs had produced a series of ruling sheikhs since assuming control of the area nomad tribes in 1756. Kuwait became a British protectorate in 1914 when German interests suddenly gave the area strategic importance. British dominance was solidified by sending British troops to the area in 1961 after Iraq sought to reclaim it. So this is Kuwait. Iraq has been trying to reclaim this since 1961. And the Pentagon had known that Iraq troops were massing along the Kuwait border since mid-July of 1990. In July 25th, Saddam sought advice from the United States on his intentions to reclaim Kuwait. He met with U.S. Ambassador April Glaspie, who told him, "I have direct instructions from President Bush to improve our relations with Iraq. We have considerable sympathy for your quest for higher oil prices, the immediate cause of your confrontation with Kuwait. I have received an instruction to ask you, in the spirit of friendship, not confrontation, regarding your intentions. Why are your troops massed so very close to Kuwait's borders?" The United States was asking Saddam Hussein. According to transcripts released long after the war, Hussein explained that while he was ready to negotiate his border dispute with Kuwait, his design was to keep the whole of Iraq in the shape we wish it to be. This shape, of course, included Kuwait, which Saddam considered still part of Iraq. "What is the United States' opinion on this?" he asked. "We have no opinion on your Arab-Arab conflicts like your dispute with Kuwait," replied Glaspie. "Secretary Baker has directed me to emphasize the instruction first given to Iraq in the 1960s that the Kuwaiti issue is not associated with America." But shortly after this, April Glaspie left Kuwait to take his summer vacation, another signal of elaborate American disinterest in the Kuwait-Iraq crisis, noted authors Tarpley and Chaitkin on George Bush, the unauthorized biography. On July 31st, Bush met with GOP congressional leader, but said nothing about the Gulf situation. The crisis escalated on August 2nd when the Iraqi troops moved into Kuwait. Bush froze all Iraqi assets in the United States, adding to Saddam's money woes, which had worsened in 1990 after international bankers refused him further loans. Oglesby was prohibited from speaking out by the State Department, so the American public could not learn of Bush's duplicity. In later testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Glassby pointed out that the July 25th conference was her first and only meeting with Saddam, who had not met with any foreign ambassador since 1984 and the midpoint of his war with Iran. But if Saddam had not met with U.S. diplomats, the same could not be said of American businessman and economist Paul Adler noted. It was known that David Rockefeller met with the Iraqi leader on at least three known occasions after the Chase Manhattan Consortium became the lead banker in a number of major Iraqi credit syndications. It was also reported that Alan Stoga, a vice president of Henry Kissinger Associates, met with Iraqi leaders during the two-year period preceding the Gulf conflict. Saddam began to realize that he could not get what he wanted from the striped pants set. He began doing business with the people who mattered to him, foreign businessmen, defense contractors, technologists, the scientists, occasionally even visiting newsmen, reported the Washington newspaper, The Spotlight. Following the money trail of such non-diplomatic contacts, which led to the Gulf War, Congressman Henry Gonzalez, chairman of the House Committee on Banking, Finance, and Urban Affairs, discovered that almost $5 billion in loans had been passed to Saddam Hussein in the 1980s through the Atlanta, Georgia branch of Italy's government-owned bank, Banca Nazionale del Lavoro. The branch manager, Christopher Drogo, was finally brought into federal court where he pleaded guilty for approving his cash transfer without the approval of the bank's head of office in Italy. However, the whole investigation was put on hold during the Gulf War. Most observers disbelieve that Drogo could have conducted such a massive transaction without the knowledge of his superiors. Bobby Lee Cook, one of Drogo's several defense attorneys, argued that his client had been made the patsy in a scheme orchestrated by the highest levels of the U.S. government. In court, the Bank Nazionale Lavoro official Fran von Wedel testified that his boss, Drogo, had acted on the advice of the bank's consultants, Kissinger Associates. In both 1989 and 1990, the Bush Justice Department had quashed indictments against the Bank Nationale by the Atlanta Attorney General's Office following an FBI raid on the bank on August 4, 1989. Actions against the bank's manager were held up for more than a year. Indictments were finally handed down one day after Bush declared a ceasefire in the Gulf War. The scandal dubbed Iraqgate prompted Gonzalez to prepare a House resolution calling for the impeachment of Bush Attorney General William Barr for obstruction of justice in the Bank Nationale scandal. Interesting, don't you find that the attorney generals of both the Bush regimes were indicted, all right, and brought before the hearings, all right, yeah, just amazing, all due to the Iraq war, the Iraq scheme. House Judiciary Committee Jackman, Committee Chairman Jack Brooks called on Barr to appoint a special prosecutor in the case. In a classic case of who will watch the watchers, Barr said he could find no evidence or wrongdoing on his part and refused to appoint a special prosecutor. It was one of the only times that an attorney general and failed to appoint a special prosecutor when asked to do so by Congress. That's freaking amazing. You see, it's just amazing how, you know, Congress has absolutely no authority. You know, nobody listens to it. The president doesn't. The Supreme Court doesn't. It's just a bunch of lunatics in there, you know. Nobody seems to listen to it. And you can see it now more than ever before. Who pays the tab? The clincher of this sordid story of financial scheming and official malfeasance was that not only had most of the $5 billion been used by Saddam to buy weaponry to be used against American servicemen, but the U.S. taxpayer picked up the tab. Gonzalez said $500 million of the loans to Saddam came through the government-backed Commodity Credit Corporation and had been intended to purchase grain from U.S. farmers. However, grain shipped through the port of Houston had gone to then Soviet bloc nations in exchange for weapons, while the remainder of the grain purchased had freed Saddam's limited cash reserves to buy more military materials. The Bush administration had pledged taxpayer guarantees should Saddam default on the loans, which he did after sending troops to Kuwait. According to at least one public source, more than $360 million in American tax money was paid to the Gulf International Bank in Bahrain, which was owned by seven Gulf nations, including Iraq. This amount was only the first of an estimated $1 billion installment to be paid in 10 banks to 10 banks by the CCC to cover the $5 billion of Saddam's defaulted loans. So we were bailing these banks out, foreign banks out, you know, back in the 90s. You know, what's different today? The numbers, actually, trillions. I just read that $29 trillion was given in that bailout to foreign banks. It's freaking sick. Absolutely sick. Of taxpayer money. Our taxpayer money. The American taxpayer money. You know, America's going into the freaking tubes. And this guy's giving $29 trillion, that's Bernanke, by the way, you know, to foreign banks. What the hell is going on? The $1 billion commitment in the form of loan guarantees for the purchase of U.S. farm commodities enabled Saddam to buy needed food on credit and to spend his scarce hard currency on the arms buildup that brought war to the Persian Gulf, wrote Russell S. Cohen. Bowen, rather. Even after the Iraqi invasion began on August 2nd, Bush publicly appeared strangely noncommittal. Asked by reporters if he intended any intervention in the Gulf crisis, Bush said, "I'm not contemplating such action." This attitude apparently changed drastically that same day after meeting with British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, a regular attendee of the Bilderberg meeting, who had been implicated with Bush in both the Iran-Contra and the October surprise scandals. After meeting with Thatcher, Bush began to describe Saddam as a new Hitler and said the status quo is unacceptable and further expansion by Iraq would be even more unacceptable. And despite assurances from Saddam that Kuwait was his only objective, and with no concrete evidence to the contrary, Bush nevertheless personally telephoned the leader of Saudi Arabia and warned that they would be the next target of the new Hitler. Panicked, the Saudis handed over as much as $4 billion to Bush and other world leaders as secret payoffs to protect their kingdom. And according to Sabah family members, Sheikh Fahd Sabah, chairman of the Kuwait Investment Office. Now they gave that money to Bush. Long after the Persian Gulf War, when audits found this money had been diverted into London's slush funds, anti-Sabah elements in Saudi Arabia criticized the payoff. They were told by al-Sabah that money was used to buy Kuwait's liberation. It paid for political leaders support for our Desert Storm, the international force we urgently needed, they quoted. Whether this money played any role or not, Bush soon drew a line in the sand and to block further Iraqi intrusion. It is interesting to note that this line was located between the Iraqi forces and oil interests owned by the soon-to-be Texas governor, George W. Bush. Ta-da! Yeah, it gets really sick, doesn't it? Bush, the president's eldest son, was a $50,000-a-year consultant to a board member of Harkin Energy, as a board member of Harkin Energy Corp. of Grand Prairie, Texas, near the home of the Texas Rangers baseball team, of which he, the younger Bush, was a managing general partner. In January 1991, just days before Desert Storm was launched, Harkin shocked the business world by announcing an oil production agreement with the small island nation of Bahrain, a former British protectorate and a haven for international bankers just off the coast of Saudi Arabia in the Persian Gulf. Bahrain was listed among the top 40 countries of the world as the highest per capita gross domestic product in 1996. Whoa. Veteran oil men wondered aloud how unknown Harkin, with no previous drilling experience, obtained such a potentially lucrative deal. Furthermore, it was reported that Harkin investments in the area will be protected by a 1990 agreement Bahrain signed with the U.S., allowing American and multinational forces to set up permanent bases in that country. Amazing, huh? We still have those bases today, folks, even though that country is completely in chaos, all right? And you have a complete dictatorship there, and they are trying to overthrow that government right now. Younger Bush in October 90 told Houston Post reporter Peter Bruton that accusations that his father ordered troops to the area to protect Harkin drilling rights were a far-fetched idea, a little far-fetched, he said. He further claimed he sold his Harkin stock before the Iraq invasion, but Bruton could find no record of the sale in the files of the Security and Exchange Commission. Records of Bush's Harkin stock sale finally turned up in March 1991, 8 months after the July 10, 1990 SEC deadline for filing such disclosures. 1 week after Saddam's troops entered Kuwait, Harkin stock dropped to $3.03 a share. Tardy SEC records revealed that by some good fortune, Bush had sold 66% of his Harkin stock on June 22, 1990, just weeks prior to the Iraq invasion, for the top dollar price of $4 a share, netting him $848,560. Despite locating productive wells in South America, the drop in oil prices in early 1999 caused Harkin stock to remain about $4 per share. Stock purchases, oil and grain deals, arms sales, loans and guarantees, the weakening of the Arabs to benefit Israel, a movement toward a global army, and government created a mind-numbing entanglement. It is doubtful whether the real reasons why the United States went to war in the Persian Gulf will ever emerge, wrote Van and Vankin and Whaley. Unlike in Vietnam, where the ambiguous outcome elicited natural suspicions, in the Gulf, the decisiveness of victory was buried, the reality deeper than any Iraqi or American soldier who went to a sandy grave. The duplicity didn't end with the fighting, and throughout the Clinton administration, there have been periodic air forays into Iraq, ostensibly to punish Saddam for preventing UN inspection of his development centers for biological and nuclear weaponry. However, this time, there was a big difference. Probing questions were raised by both a suspicious public and a few less timid members of the news media. Following missile and bombing strikes in late 1998, a letter writer to a national news magazine asked, "By using weapons of mass destruction to deter Iraq from manufacturing weapons of mass destruction, would America not be doing the very thing we're warning Iraq not to do?" Others raised the question of why we attacked Iraq for refusing UN inspection of its sensitive military installations when President Clinton also had refused to allow such inspections in the United States, our refusal greeted with general approval by the public. Scott Ritter, a member of the United Nations Special Commission, created to locate and eliminate Saddam Hussein's secret weapon caches, resigned in August of 1998 and accused the U.S. government of using the commission to justify an attack on Iraq. Ritter said that before his resignation, he disbelieved Baghdad's Minister of Defense when he told him that the U.S. That UNSCOM team was being used to provoke a crisis, but he slowly came to agree with the charge. Ritter's superiors scoffed at the allegation, claiming Ritter's knowledge of the situation was limited. I'll just end this here. However, in early 1999, it was reported that Washington had used UNSCOM to plant electric bugs in the Ministry of Defense. The Pentagon and other U.S. officials confirmed much of Ritter's accusations. The relationship between the United States and the Inspection Commission had long been a subject of debate, wrote U.S. news reporter Bruce Auster. The issue is sensitive because UNSCOM is an arm of the U.N. Security Council, not an agency of the United States, although it does rely on the United States for intelligence and personnel. On December 5, 1998, after stockpiling cruise missiles in the Persian Gulf during the fall of the U.S. Launch, a much-delayed airstrike against Baghdad. But with Christmas nearing, most Americans could not get too worked up over civilian casualties halfway around the world. And any doubt about U.S. involvement in the Persian Gulf, except among those unfortunates having to deal with Gulf War syndrome, caused by a lethal combination of oil fires, biological agents, and radioactive uranium-tipped artillery and tank shells, had been thrown away along with the yellow ribbons, which had proudly displayed the total support of the uninformed. And with that, I'm going to end the show tonight. This goes on, and I may continue it because it's excellent. How JFK opposed the globalists and so on, and how he got shot. So I want to thank everybody who joined me tonight, and hope you enjoyed the show. And have a very pleasant evening.